Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Underwood and Flinch Underground, episode 20, version 2. Some of you may have heard version 1, which I hurriedly put online yesterday in order to meet the monthly deadline thing. There, as I said in that episode, if you heard it, I hadn't checked it, and it wasn't really finished, but I just had to get it out, and get it out I did. And if you heard it, then congratulations, because it's gone now, and it will never see the light of day again, because there were things in there that I wasn't really happy with, and I went to bed last night and woke up this morning and knew that things just had to be changed. So I've changed those now, and this version you have in your ears is version 2. It's like, I'd say it's 98%, 99% exactly the same, but there's about 2 or 3 minutes that have been adjusted. But they are important, you know, minutes. So if you have listened to the first version, then you do need to listen to this version, because this version is now the definitive version. This is kind of what it's like, you know, when you're writing a book, you do this all the time. Of course, what most writers get to do is to work on their novel and finish their novel and go back and edit and change things accordingly, so as they get the end result that they want. But I can't do that. I have to write and edit and finish to perfection my chapters long before I actually even finish the book. Some things, certain words or sentences can be changed, but other things, key things like what I've had to change in from version 1 to version 2, that kind of stuff just has to be done. You can't leave that and say, oh, well, I'll do that later, you know, because it has to be done now, because the subsequent events that will happen from now will very much depend on what happens in episode 20. Sorry, I'm just sort of trying to explain and probably not doing a very good job of it. Anyway, this episode picks up from the previous episode, basically, in which David found himself to be a prisoner of the sect in the sect house in London, for his own good, of course. You know, they're just protecting him and making sure no harm comes to him. But, he's not going anywhere. And that's basically where we pick up. Elizabeth Daventry has, you know, had her chat with him and gone. And we start this episode with David alone and reading the newspapers. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, the definitive Underwood and Flinch, episode 20. I hope you enjoy it. Underwood and Flinch, Underground. A novel written and performed for podcast by Mike Bennett. This novel is intended for an adult audience. Episode 20. Ronnie Bishop. The name was one of many things in the original London Vampire news piece that David had underlined in the previous evening's London Courier, but it was only the name of the journalist that he was now writing on his forearm. He checked again to ensure that Tully and Kendall weren't watching him. They continued to chat quietly in the doorway, neither of them looking in his direction. David turned the pages to the Courier's editorial details and found the contact number for anyone who wanted to report a story. He scribbled the number on his arm under Bishop's name and, with a final glance at Tully and Kendall, tugged down his sleeve and rebuttoned his cuff. He then sat back in his seat at the table in the bay window and lit a fresh cigarette from the one he'd been smoking. He didn't particularly want to chain smoke, but Kendall wouldn't allow him to have a lighter, claiming it was a potential weapon. David sighed a stream of smoke and looked out of the window into the gathering dusk. He'd read the London Vampire coverage in all the newspapers Elizabeth Daventry had given him. She'd been right in saying that they all basically rehashed Ronnie Bishop's original piece. Clearly, Bishop was the man the sect needed to talk to, but Elizabeth hadn't mentioned him once. Maybe that penny hadn't dropped with her. He could have pointed it out, but after she had informed him he was essentially being held a prisoner of the sect, he'd seen no reason to cooperate with her or Daventry and West any further. She'd asked him more questions, focusing almost exclusively on the idea that someone from La Fantasia could have been turned into a vampire, and he'd answered, though without expanding in any way on what he'd already told them, and definitely not saying a word about his fears concerning Damo. Damo, the London vampire. It was almost too awful to contemplate, but it was the only thing that made sense. That his friend had become infected by Lydia's bite and by ingesting Underwood's blood was highly probable. If that were the case, he would have had a motive for killing Lisa, namely, revenge upon David, because, arguably, it should have been David and not Damo who had ended up in Lydia's fateful embrace. At La Fantasia, Damo had drawn Lydia's attack away from David and inadvertently onto himself. That wasn't David's fault, but Damo, if he were now a vampire, may not see it so reasonably. David had imagined him waking up, transformed, realizing all that he'd lost, and then deciding who was to blame for it. Lydia would obviously be the first person, but once he'd learned that she was dead, he could then have turned to David as the next in line. It wouldn't have taken long for him to discover that David was in jail, so who did that leave for him to exact his revenge upon, except David's loved ones? And that would have meant Lisa. News of Lisa's death would have reached David in prison. He imagined that Damo would have left two bite marks on the neck, just so there could be no doubt as to how she had died. Perhaps he would even have left a note addressed to David as a means of revealing himself. The more David thought about it, the more layered and complex the scenario became in his mind. He'd imagined various possibilities for the note, sometimes a fake suicide note from Lisa with a veiled reference to Damo, sometimes a direct message from him, like the one he was composing in his mind now. She was sweet, just like you said when we were on the road to Malaga. On the road to Malaga. That was when he had told Damo about her. It had been a long drive, and once they'd gone through all the possible strategies of the fight that lay before them at La Fantasia, they'd started talking about other things, including family and girlfriends. David had told him about his life with Lisa, where they lived, how things had been between them before John had called him to Spain, and how he still hoped that he could get back to some kind of normal relationship with her once, if he got out of Spain in one piece. He hadn't given him their actual address, but all Damo would have had to do to find it would have been to go out to Casa Underwood and look for it. Once he had it, he could then have gone to England to find her. David imagined him calling at the door, fixing her eyes with his and smiling. "Lisa, I'm a friend of David's." She would then have taken him up to the flat, and here he found he couldn't, wouldn't imagine. Instead, he moved forward in his imagination to the part where Damo got Lisa to phone him. Better than a note, an actual message on his telephone. "David, this is Lisa. Your Irish friend sends his regards." But David hadn't answered. Damo wouldn't have expected that. So then he'd changed his plan. He'd decided to use Lisa as bait to infect her as he had been infected and leave her as a trap to infect David in turn. And the rest was history. David went to take a drag on his cigarette and its ash tumbled onto his shirt. He saw his hand was trembling, not with fear, but with anger. He put the cigarette between his lips and clenched his fist, willing himself to be calm, rational, not to let emotion, based on what was only a theory, overwhelm him. He opened his hand, extending the fingers, and was relieved to see it was once again steady. He didn't like his theory, but it added up better than anything else. The only question was, while someone could certainly have done the things that he'd imagined Damo had done, could Damo actually have done them? Would he have had it in him to be such an inhuman bastard? But then, inhuman was the key word, wasn't it? The man he had known was dead, and whatever was walking around in Damo's skin was now literally inhuman. He was a vampire. He'd killed Lisa, and now he was very likely hunting the streets of London for David. And if he found him here, in this house opposite Hyde Park, what then? David turned back to look at Tully and Kendall. Both of them, he now knew, were armed with tasers, and possibly something more lethal, though Elizabeth seemed to think that tasers would be adequate to the task. She'd obviously never seen a man turn to mist before. If Damo had learned that particular trick, a taser was going to be as much good as a fly swatter. But just for the sake of argument, supposing they did bring him down, what then? The sect theory was that he could be reined in and made to live according to the rules of their so-called code. But was that justice for Lisa, he thought? Hardly. Damo should be made to pay. He should be... He wanted to say destroyed, but he couldn't bring himself to. Damo was, had been, his friend. While it wasn't David's fault that Damo had become a vampire, it had happened as a direct result of Damo saving David's life. David owed him, and just sitting here while all this shit was happening out there was unbearable to him. He had to get out there and find Damo, track him down and get to the truth, and not with the likes of Tully and Kendall waving tasers in his face either. He needed to speak to him alone. Right now, Damo was experiencing a change that no one other than Underwood could have understood. It was fair to say that he was probably experiencing a kind of temporary insanity. If that were true, then he could almost forgive Lisa's murder and try to move on and to help him. He could try to convince Damo to come in to Daventry and West and accept their help in adapting to his new way of life. But if he had become a monster, unreasonable and unrepentant, then he would do what had to be done. He would kill Damo. Or Damo would kill him. He reached across the table for the bottle of vodka he'd managed to convince Tully to furnish him with. He'd played up his alcoholic credentials, saying that he'd be climbing the walls without it. Kendall had been reluctant, but Tully was apparently the ranking man and had had the final say. David twisted the cap and broke the seal, then poured a measure into his glass. He added a splash of soda, then raised the glass before him. "Que sera, sera, Damo," he said under his breath. "Whatever will be, will be." Anyone eavesdropping on David, Tully and Kendall that evening could be excused for thinking the three men were the greatest of chums. They were watching television, where a repeat episode of Only Fools and Horses had them all laughing together like a happy family. Tully and Kendall seemed to take their cue to laugh straight from the canned laughter track that erupted from the TV every few moments. David laughed along with them, though often lagging behind by a few seconds, as if it took longer for the joke to click with his vodka-soaked brain. Or, at least, that was the impression he wanted to convey. If David knew anything, it was how to appear drunk. He sat in an armchair near the fireplace, glancing frequently from the corner of his eye to check on Tully, who sat on the couch, and Kendall, who stood leaning against the wall by the door. On the screen, Delboy sent another zinging put-down at Rodney. Tully laughed on cue and turned to Kendall to repeat the line with gusto. "You plonker, Rodney!" Kendall laughed, and David shifted in his seat, seemingly to laugh along with them, but actually to spill another glass of vodka down between the arm of his chair and the seat cushion. Though the bottle was roughly two-thirds empty, David had only drunk a couple of glasses of it. Most of its contents were either down the side of the seat cushion or soaked into the carpet between David's chair and the wall. "What a plonker!" David slurred happily as he leaned forward to take up the bottle from the coffee table. Tully saw this, and his smile faded to a look of concern. "Don't you think that maybe you've had enough, Mr. Flinch?" "How can I have had enough?" said David. "There's still some in the bottle, isn't there? Enough is when it's empty, Tully."
"I don't know, sir. I'm told you've been off it for a while. You mightn't be able to handle it like you used to."
"Oh, right, they told you that then, did they? Personal shit's all right, but useful shit, like where the fuck my trainers are, that's top secret. Come on, mate, tell us where they are. I ain't going nowhere, am I?"
"I think you should go to bed, Mr. Flinch," said Kendall. "You've had enough for one night, sir."
"Bollocks to that," said David. "It's only just past 7 o'clock. What am I, a baby?"
"You're pissed is what you are, sir," said Kendall. He looked at Tully. "I knew we shouldn't have let him have that bottle. Look at him."
"He's all right," said Tully. "Better that than have him pacing up and down asking bleeding questions all the time. That was driving me mad."
"Sorry, Tully," said David, spilling himself another glass of vodka.
"I didn't mean to, but I was worried, you know."
"Yeah, I know, sir. But Kendall's right. You should be calling it a night. We don't want you to be so fucked you can't get up in the morning."
"Why, what's happening in the morning? Miss Daventry coming round with the papers, is she?"
"I've no idea, sir. But it's nice to be able to greet her if she does, isn't it?"
"You should have thought of that before you gave him the sauce," said Kendall.
"Well, how was I to know he's going to drink the whole fucking bottle?" said Tully.
"He's an alky, isn't he? That's what they do."
"That's what we do," said David with a grin. "Cheers."
He drank the contents of his glass down in one.
"Okay, that's it," said Tully. "Time for bed, sir."
He got up and beckoned for David to come to him.
"Come on."
David pouted, but he could see that both Tully and Kendall were determined. He didn't want Tully coming over and seeing the damp patch down the side of his cushion, so he got up.
"Okay, but only because I'm tired. Don't think I'm doing this because you want me to... Oh!"
He staggered, almost falling back down before righting himself by catching the arm of the chair. He grinned and straightened up.
"Almost."
Tully again beckoned.
"Come on, sir, I'll help you up." "I don't need help," said David, walking round the sofa away from Tully. "I can manage fine on my own."
"Yeah, and end up sleeping in the broom cupboard," said Kendall, stepping into the doorway to block David's exit.
"Do you want to do it or shall I?" said Tully.
"You're all right," said Kendall. "I'll do it. Then you come up and relieve me in about 10, yeah?"
"Nice one, Merv," said Tully. "Good night, Mr. Flinch."
"Good night, Tully," said David.
"Are you coming to tap me in, Merv?"
"No, sir, but I'm going to watch over you while you sleep."
"Ah, like a guardian angel. Merv the guardian angel. Can I call you Merv, Merv?"
"I prefer Kendall, sir."
"Okay, Merv,"
said David as Kendall placed a hand at his back to steer him out of the room.
"Whatever you say. Where's my room?"
"Just up the stairs, sir."
"I need to pee."
"That's all right. You've got your own bathroom, remember?"
"Oh, yeah. Are you going to come to the bathroom with me?"
"No, sir. You can do that on your own. But I'd appreciate it if you left the door open just in case you fall and need help."
"What if I want to shit? I ain't shitting with the door open, Merv."
"We'll cross that bridge when we come to it, sir."
They got to the stairs. David had planned it as the ideal opportunity to get Kendall closer to him. He went to take a step, missed his footing and fell against the banister. Kendall caught him, putting his arm around David's back and lifting him from under the shoulder.
"Easy does it, sir. Let me lead." "Are we going dancing, Merv?"
"No, sir. Come on, one step at a time."
David hung on to Kendall and started to climb the stairs.
"You know, "You're all right, Merv," he said, giving Kendall's shoulder a squeeze. "I gotta say, I wasn't too pleased about being banged up here, but as jailers go, you and old Tully, you're all right."
"Thank you, sir," said Kendall, turning slightly from David's sour breath. "Glad to hear it." By the time they reached the top floor where David's room was located, David had affected a convincingly dozy demeanour, as if the concentration required to navigate the flights of stairs had sapped his last reserves of strength. His head lolled forwards, and he had all but stopped speaking. Kendall was supporting most of his weight as he led them down the hall. "Nearly there, Mr. Flinch. Just a little further."
"I know, done it, Merv," said David, his voice heavily slurred.
"Done what, sir?" said Kendall as they came to the bedroom door. He opened it and turned on the light.
"Who killed Lisa? My girlfriend?"
Kendall, whose attention to his burden's drunken ramblings had hitherto just been professional courtesy, now realised that David was on the verge of telling him exactly what the partners wanted to know. He remained nonchalant, not wanting to wake David from his drunken willingness to confide.
"All right, sir. Who was that, then?"
"Insuba. Sec,"
David slurred.
"Who?"
asked Kendall, leaning his ear closer.
"I didn't."
David suddenly stood upright, catching Kendall completely off guard. His right arm, which had been hanging onto Kendall's shoulder, was suddenly around his throat, and his left arm clamped behind his head, locking the man into a rear-naked chokehold. Kendall couldn't speak, couldn't breathe. He grabbed at David's arm, but couldn't find purchase.
"Easy, Merv," said David. "Just let it happen, mate. You're all right. I was an army medic. I know what I'm doing."
Kendall managed a last ineffectual slap against David's arm before his body went limp and David gathered him up to lay him on the bed. He then began a search of Kendall's body. The first thing he did was take the taser from the shoulder holster under Kendall's arm. He tossed it to the end of the bed in between Kendall's feet, then frisked the rest of him. In his inside jacket pocket, he found a small, narrow, plastic box that he recognised as a syringe kit. He opened it to see a hypodermic syringe and a small bottle of clear fluid. He read the label on the bottle. The drug was called Ultiva, which David knew was the trade name for the analgesic Remifentanil. Either Kendall was a recreational drug fiend, or this was a knockout shot intended to be used on him in case he ever needed to be subdued. David quickly filled the syringe with a safe but potent dose, enough to keep Kendall out for at least 30 minutes, and injected it directly into a vein in the man's arm.
"There you go, Merv," he said with a smile. "Pleasant dreams."
Then he went through the rest of his pockets. He found a wallet, keys, mobile phone, and the lighter Kendall had refused to give him for security reasons.
"Quite right, too," said David as he pocketed it, along with the phone and all the cash in the wallet, which came to £60.
Then he eased Kendall out of his jacket and unbuckled his shoulder holster. Next, he took off his own jacket. Kendall was roughly the same size and build as him, so he only needed to make a few minor adjustments to the shoulder holster before putting it on and settling it into place. He holstered the taser, put his jacket back on, then went into the bathroom to check in the mirror that the weapon was adequately concealed. Then he went back to the bedroom door. He opened it a crack and looked out. On seeing no one, he stepped out and closed the door behind him. He listened. From far away came the sound of canned laughter, followed by Tully's. David let out the breath he'd been holding and started down the stairs. He trod lightly, the plush carpet absorbing the sound of his footfalls, till he got to the ground floor, where he paused to look to the open doors of the drawing room. He couldn't see Tully, but a fresh wave of laughter from him and the canned audience told him he was still on the couch, glued to Del Boy's antics. He moved quickly and silently down to the front door, opened it, stepped outside, and on the next peal of laughter from within, pulled it softly closed behind him. Once he was on the street, he looked left and right and saw in the distance an illuminated London Underground sign. He started in that direction and took out Kendall's phone. He went into the menu and got the telephone number of the phone, which he then said several times under his breath until he had it memorized. Then, from where he had written it on his arm, he thumbed in the number for the London Evening Courier's news desk. After a few rings, a man answered. David asked for Ronnie Bishop.
Ronnie's not a staffer, he's freelance,
said the man.
What's it about? I'm sure I can help you.
No, I need to talk to Ronnie about the London Vampire, said David. I've got information, something your paper is going to want, but I'll only speak to him. Can you give me his number?
Whoa, let's not be too hasty,
said the man, his voice suddenly interested. David pictured him reaching for a pencil and paper.
There's no need to go through a third party, sir. You can tell me whatever it is, and if there's a story in it, we can maybe throw a few quid your way. That's a lot more than Ronnie can do.
Yeah, no doubt, but this isn't about money. I'm a big fan of his, and I want him to have the story. So, will you give me his number, or do I have to speak to some other paper he deals with?
No. Hang on. I can't just give out his private number. I've an email I can...
No, I need to speak to Ronnie. Call him, tell him what I've told you, and then have him call me back on this number.
The journalist agreed, and David gave him Kendall's number. Then he hung up. After no more than 3 minutes, the phone rang. He looked at the number. Most likely it was for Kendall, possibly even someone from Daventry and West, but hopefully it was Bishop. David thumbed the connect button and answered with a neutral, "Yeah?" There was a pause at the other end of the line. David heard the hum of many voices, the clink of glasses, the unmistakable sound of a pub. Then the caller spoke.
"This is Ronnie Bishop. Who am I talking to?"
"Mr. Bishop, thanks for calling. My name is... well, you can call me David."
"Okay, David. So, what's this story of yours? And why are you only willing to give it to me?"
"Like I told the guy at the paper, I'm a fan of yours."
"People like me don't have fans, mate. Come on, stop messing about. What's the story?"
"I'll only tell you in person. Can you meet me?"
"Not unless you give me some idea what it's about. They told me you're calling about a vampire, is that right?"
"That's right."
"Who are you? Police?"
"No, but I'm working with them. I know what's happening on the inside."
"Oh, yeah?"
said Ronnie.
"So, how about you throw me a bone then? Just a little tidbit so I know you're not a bullshitter."
"I'm not going to tell you over the phone, Ronnie. People could be listening in."
"Listening in?"
Ronnie laughed.
"On me? You must be confusing me with someone who matters a fuck. Come on, give me a taster or I'm hanging up."
"Okay," said David. "Let's start with the fact that there are two separate killers."
A pause. Then Ronnie said,
"Go on."
"The body in the skip was cleaned and dumped. The one in the church was done there and then."
"How do you know this?"
"Like I said, I'm working with the police."
"I see. All right then, Mr. David. Where do you want to meet?"
"Where are you now? It's a pub, right?"
"Yeah, the Kingsway Tavern."
"Where's that?"
"Kingsway."
"Well, what's the nearest tube?"
"Holborn."
"Okay, I'll be there in 10 minutes. How will I know you?"
"You won't, but I'll know you. What are you wearing?"
"I don't know, black jacket, white shirt."
"It's a bit vague. I'll tell you what, bring a copy of this evening's Courier with you, stick it under your arm and buy a packet of cheese and onion crisps and a pint of Guinness. I'll ring you when I see you and you can bring them over to me."
"Yeah, make it 2 pints, mate," said David. "I've had a rough day."
"Fine, I'll see you later."
David ended the call and pocketed the phone. Earlier, as he had left the house, he hadn't noticed the two men standing at a bus stop a short distance away on the opposite side of the road. Once he had started walking, apparently lost within his phone, they had moved together and one of them said,
"Looks like Tally and Kendall owe us 20 quid apiece, Roy."
"Yes, indeed, Jim," said the other. "And on the first night, too. Dear, oh dear. We should have bet more on his getting out, shouldn't we?"
He folded the copy of the Evening Courier he'd been pretending to read and tucked it under his arm.
"Okay, I'll go into the house and see what's happened to them two muppets. You follow Flinch and see what he gets up to."
"Roger that. Do you want to call her or shall I?"
"No, you do it," said Roy. "I've got a feeling I'm going to have my hands full with Tally and Kendall. Let's hope he hasn't fucking killed them. I want my 20 quid. He started across the road.
"Hey, if he's left them bound and gagged, take a picture before you let him go, will you?"
"Yeah, and Facebook it," said Roy with a grin. "That'd be fucking priceless."
"Yeah, if only, eh?"
Jim set off in pursuit of David, walking briskly to catch him up and almost flank him on the opposite side of the wide road. He connected to a number on his phone and slipped it back into his pocket. When the call was answered, he spoke into his Bluetooth device.
"Miss Daventry?"
"It's Glover, ma'am. He's out. I'm pursuing in the direction of Lancaster Gate Underground."
"No, ma'am. He won't get away from me. He don't even know I'm on him."
And so, listeners, David begins his journey underground. Armed with a flick knife and a head full of wrong deductions about Damo, and being pursued by a member of the sect. What could possibly go wrong? Join me next time for episode 21 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Arma by Farid Farjad, courtesy of Taraneh Records, specialists in Persian music. You can download the track online from iTunes or Amazon, and of course you can stream it using Spotify. This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you, and all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution. I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.